it's time for the Des Moines Register on Monday, April 22nd. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. My name is Twyla Glenn, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Scott Splavey. Scott's usually the rolling along with the wheels behind the scene here, and today he's at the microphone. Welcome to the microphone, Scott. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinion, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and from donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and headlines from today's Des Moines Register. According to AccuWeather across the state, it should be rather cloudy and windy today. A couple of showers, but dry in the south and near Des Moines. Winds south-southwest 15 to 25 miles per hour. And the forecast through the weekend for the, the forecast for the next few days will look like this. Through about Thursday, we'll give you the forecast. Today, a high of 71 and a low of 51. Windy today with intervals of clouds and sunshine. Winds south-southwest 15 to 25 miles per hour. A couple of showers Monday night with winds southwest 10 to 20 miles per hour. On Tuesday, a high of 68 with a low of 39. Windy with clouds and sun. On Wednesday, mostly sunny with a high of 64 and a low of 44. And on Thursday, look for showers with a high of 66 and a low of 52. Tracking precipitation in the 24 hours ending 4 p.m. Saturday, there was zero precipitation. Our month-to-date is 1.35 inches against a normal of 2.41 inches. Our year-to-date has been 6.06 inches against a normal of 7.06 inches. Last year by this date, we had had 7.42 inches of precipitation. Sunrise today was at 6:24 a.m. Sunset tonight, 8:03 p.m. Moonrise today, 7:05 p.m. Moonset today, 5:46 a.m. And now turning to the front page of the Des Moines Register, here are the headlines. The first one, accompanied by a big picture of a row of slot machines, says the county is caught in an odd legal fight. Polk County could both win and lose in the Prairie Meadows tax case. Blank Children's Hospital sees an influx, and Iowa's medical cannabis law is one of the strictest in the nation. Now, here with the first story is Scott.
Thank you, Twyla, and I'll start with county caught in odd legal fight. Polk County could win and lose in Prairie Meadow case. It's written by Tyler Jett of the Des Moines Register. In an odd legal fight, Polk County leaders are opposing cutting the government's own tax burden. The county, which owns the land and buildings where Prairie Meadows Racetrack and Casino operates in Altoona, is disputing an appeal from the casino to lower its property appraisal. In a review of the property last year, the county assessor's office valued Prairie Meadows around $181 million, a $75 million increase from the prior assessment. That would increase the property's annual tax bill about two-thirds to $6 million, Prairie Meadows CEO Gary Palmer told the Des Moines Register. The casino's lawyers have argued that the county's assessment is significantly too high, and a Polk County District Court judge has scheduled a trial on the challenge for June 17th. If Polk County wins, Polk County stands to lose. As part of the casino's current five-year lease agreement starting in 2019, the county supervisors agreed to cover the first $4.5 million in annual property tax payments. Last year, the county covered the entire $3.6 million bill. If the judge upholds the county's increased assessment, Prairie Meadows would have to pay about $1.5 million. But the county would have to pay the full $4.5 million it pledged in a $900,000 increase. In addition to arguing that the most recent appraisal was too high, the casino's lawyers told the judge in June 2023 legal filing that the property should actually be exempt from taxes. The lawyers pointed to state laws that say publicly owned land used for athletic events, conventions, and charitable purposes is not subject to property taxes. Prairie Meadows is a nonprofit and donates to local social, cultural, and charitable organizations. In 2022, the casino issued $27 million in grants, according to tax filings. The property also hosts meetings and conventions. The court case puts Polk County officials in an odd position. If a judge rules that the county is exempt from taxes, the county will save the tax payments it currently makes to Altoona, the Southeast Polk Community School District, Des Moines Area Community College, and Broadlands Medical Center. In an interview with the Register on Wednesday, Polk County Administrator John Norris rejected the idea of intentionally losing the case. He said county leaders need to support appraisals made by the county assessor's office. "We're not going to interject ourselves to a decision about market value," Norris said. "If we did, we're politicizing market value. That is something government shouldn't do." He added, "Losing would save us money, but it reduces revenue for us and everyone else." Norris said the relationship between the county and Prairie Meadows is a one-off, an odd pairing that doesn't exist anywhere else in the region. The county took over the racetrack in 1993 when the supervisors issued bonds to pay off Prairie Meadows' debts after the Nonprofit Racing Association of Central Iowa filed for bankruptcy 2 years after the track's opening. The county leases the property to the casino operator, receiving rent and a percentage of revenue. At times, the arrangement has made for strange bedfellows. Casino board members, county supervisors, and state regulators have argued about how much control the county can exert. In the early years of the agreement, the county received a larger share of casino revenues. County supervisors doled out some of that money to local school districts, giving the county influence over education officials. In 1997, Altoona and Southeast Polk leaders exerted some control by lobbying the legislature to pass a bill that forced the county to pay property taxes on the casino property. "To my knowledge, that law has not been tested," said Tom Flynn, the casino's longtime attorney. "If we wanted to hang our hat and make that the primary point of our appeal, it may get tested." The county attorney's office rescued itself from the case, and the private firm of Dickinson, Bradshaw, Fowler, and Hagen is representing the government. Under the current lease, Prairie Meadows pays $15.9 million in annual rent. The casino also gives the county 5% of its first $225 million of annual adjusted gross receipts, as well as 1% of revenue above that mark. In 2022, that came out to about $11.9 million. Of the property taxes Polk County paid on the Prairie Meadows property in the most recent year, $1.4 million went to Altoona, $1.3 million went to the Southeast Polk School District, $205,000 went to Broadlands, and $58,000 went to DMAC. Polk County retained about $538,000 of those taxes. Smaller amounts went to Des Moines Area Regional Transit, the County Assessor's Office, and the local Iowa State University Extension and Outreach Office. The casino received the county's latest appraisal last April. Prairie Meadows officials appealed the $75 million increase to the Polk County Board of Review, arguing that the property value should not have increased at all. Flynn said Prairie Meadows' lease and its obligation to give a cut of revenue to the county deflates the property's value. The Board of Review agreed last June to cut the valuation by about $240,000. The casino, seeking a deeper cut in the property's valuation, appealed the case to Polk County District Court last July. Polk County's appraiser, we're quite certain, did not take the lease into account, Flynn said. The casino also appealed in 2019 when the county assessor increased the appraisal of the Prairie Meadows property to about $147 million, up from about $105 million. As with the current assessment, the casino's attorneys argued that Prairie Meadows property should be tax exempt. However, the casino dismissed the case in April 2021 before a scheduled trial. Flynn said the county had agreed to decrease the valuation to its prior level without a court hearing. The county made that decision 1 year into the COVID-19 pandemic when many people were staying home as much as possible, a damper on the casino business. Norris said the county assessor also agreed at the time to decrease the assessed value of many hospitality businesses like hotels and restaurants due to plummeting revenue. Asked whether Polk County would benefit by supporting Prairie Meadows' argument that the land should be tax-exempt, Flynn declined to speculate. If the county wants to pay taxes, the county can pay taxes, he said. If the taxes stay under $4.5 million, the amount the county has agreed to pay each year, it's really academic as far as we're concerned. Palmer, the casino's CEO, declined to say whether the county would benefit from a Prairie Meadows court victory. He said the casino would rather issue that money to charities than give it to the government. He added that he simply thinks the current appraisal is too high. We would not be very good businessmen if we just said, oh, okay, we'll send you more money because you said so, he told the Register.
Blank Children's Hospital sees an influx. Doctors are reporting a surge in respiratory illnesses. A Des Moines Children's Hospital is wrestling with an influx in seriously ill pediatric patients amid unseasonably high activity of respiratory viruses this spring. Over the past several weeks, staff at Blank Children's Hospital say they have seen an unusually high number of young patients hospitalized because of respiratory illnesses such as influenza and respiratory syncytial virus known as RSV. This year's respiratory viral season has extended later into the year than usual, with winter viruses now overlapping with viral activity typically seen during the spring. As a result, doctors at the Metro Hospital say they are dealing with a spike in admissions among young patients who are suffering from serious infections, putting a serious strain on their inpatient capacity. The inpatient units have been at capacity many times over the past several weeks, said Dr. Wendy Woods, vice president and medical director at Blank Children's Hospital. We start the day full, have several discharges, then fill again. Officials at Mercy One Children's Hospital in Des Moines say they are not experiencing a similar spike in pediatric admissions. At Mercy One, we continually monitor public health trends to ensure that we can effectively serve every patient who walks through our doors. There are always transient surges, but we are not seeing any significant increase in volume related to pediatric respiratory illnesses, said Allie Bechter, a spokesperson for Mercy One. Doctors at Blank Children's Hospital say the majority of children admitted to the hospital in recent weeks are being treated for viral bronchitis and viral gastroenteritis, both of which are infections that are caused by certain viruses. That's on top of the normal day-to-day admissions, Woods said, including pneumonia, traumas, and routine admissions for chemotherapy treatment. The number of hospitalized patients varies by the hour, Woods said, as the hospital can admit and discharge 15 to 20 kids in a 24-hour period. That number alone does not seem problematic, but the viral gastroenteritis season is overlapping with the respiratory season, and the result is the spike in admissions and capacity issues, she said. Also known as the stomach flu, viral gastroenteritis can be caused by viruses such as noroviruses and rotaviruses, both of which are common among children. Bronchiolitis, or a lung infection, is typically caused by RSV, a common virus among young children. Admissions for gastroenteritis from dehydration at Blank Children's are 30% higher in the first quarter of this year compared to 2023, Woods said. In addition, roughly 40% of the kids hospitalized last week have a respiratory illness that is requiring support with oxygen or ventilation, Woods said. That's about 10% higher this year compared to last year. This recent spike in hospitalizations among children in Des Moines comes even as COVID-19 and influenza activity is declining statewide after a wintertime spike in infections. Flu activity is low and COVID-19 activity is very low as of the week ending April 13, the most recent data available from state public health officials. The Iowa Department of Health and Human Services reported 46 Iowans were hospitalized with the flu and 31 were hospitalized with COVID-19 infections as of April 13. At the winter height, more than 400 Iowans were hospitalized with COVID-19 in Iowa in late December. Influenza caused more than 180 hospitalizations statewide in late February and early March. Nationwide, respiratory virus season appears to be past its peak, but it's definitely not over, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, known as CDC. The coronavirus pandemic challenged the normal pattern of respiratory viral season in Iowa and across the rest of the country. After COVID-19, Wood said local doctors have seen more overlap of viral seasons in recent years than they have historically, with some viruses like RSV sticking around for longer than usual. Overall, there has been a disruption in the seasonality of viruses in children since the COVID-19 pandemic, Wood said. Doctors have also had to contend with influxes in seriously ill children after the pandemic. 2 years ago, Iowa hospitals were slammed by a triple-demic of respiratory illnesses, filling emergency rooms and urgent care clinics with young patients infected with COVID-19, flu, and RSV. While still worse than pre-pandemic years, the CDC has found the nation's respiratory illness season this year is closer to a typical pre-pandemic season than it was last year. Federal public health officials say flu and RSV illnesses increased later in the fall, which is more likely what we typically saw before the pandemic. In addition, COVID-19, flu, and RSV hospitalizations were not as high as last year, resulting in less strain on the healthcare system broadly, according to the CDC. Federal and state officials still encourage individuals to use precautions to keep themselves and their loved ones healthy. That includes seeking out vaccines for COVID-19, influenza, and RSV if they are eligible. However, Iowa is far below the recommended vaccination rate. As of last week, only about 15% of the state's population were fully vaccinated against COVID-19, and about 34% of all Iowans had received a flu shot. If their children have a respiratory infection or the stomach flu, Woods encouraged parents to talk with their pediatrician or primary care provider to better understand how to care for their kids and how to keep them hydrated. Providers can also advise families on worrisome signs and symptoms that they should call their doctor about, she said.
Thank you, Twyla. Iowa's medical cannabis law, one of strictest in the nation. This is written by Michaela Rahm of the Des Moines Register. 10 years ago this month, Iowa policymakers made it legal to use cannabis for certain medical treatment, marking the start of what would eventually become Iowa's existing medical cannabidiol program. The law, approved in April 2014, allowed certain patients to use cannabis oil for their health condition. It was the first time a state law let Iowans use marijuana products for their medical care. Iowa policymakers have since opened the door further and established Iowa's medical cannabidiol program to oversee the cultivation, manufacturing, and sale of cannabis products to a greater number of patients with qualifying medical conditions. But a decade later, Iowa's program remains one of the most restrictive in the nation, even as more than 50,000 Iowans have participated since it launched in 2018. Regulatory officials overseeing the state cannabidiol program say a tight framework is necessary to ensure the safety and well-being of Iowans. Advocates of expanded availability, on the other hand, say the program's restrictions means patients in Iowa can't access the full benefits of cannabis products. Here's a look back on Iowa's history with cannabis and how the state program compares with others nationwide. Iowa's medical program is incredibly limited and is not considered by advocates as effective policy, said Morgan Fox, political director for advocacy group National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, or NORML. In total, 48 states allow for cannabis use in some form, according to NORML, of those 37 states, and Washington, D.C. also have what the group describes as a comprehensive medical program. One of the reasons Fox said Iowa has fallen behind is because of its limitations on THC, or tetrahydrocannabidiol, the main psychoactive component of cannabis, which gives users a high. Under current law, Iowans can purchase up to 4.5 grams of THC every 90 days, with exceptions for those who obtain a waiver. As a result, some patients who could benefit from higher THC formulations, such as cancer patients or those who need help with pain management, struggle to access those products. Seriously ill patients in Iowa are incredibly limited in the amount they can attain through the cannabidiol program, Fox said. In April of 2014, the Iowa legislature approved a measure that allowed Iowans to use cannabis oil without facing criminal prosecution to treat epilepsy. But the bill signed into law by then-Governor Terry Branstad prohibited any manufacturing or distribution of that oil within the state. The program saw a significant expansion in May of 2017 with the passage of the Iowa Medical Cannabidiol Act, which made cannabis products available to thousands more Iowans by expanding the list of qualifying medical conditions. The law also allowed marijuana plants to be grown within the state and for manufacturers to develop and distribute cannabis oil that contained up to 3% THC. The first dispensaries licensed under the Iowa Medical Cannabidiol Program began selling medical cannabidiol products to patients on December the 1st, 2018. The program has continued to expand in the years since, adding more qualifying medical conditions and adding additional products available for sale. However, that growth has been limited by policymakers. In one instance, Governor Kim Reynolds vetoed legislation that would have removed the then 3% cap on THC within products, citing a belief that expansion of the program should be done cautiously. Currently, the medical cannabidiol program allows for 2 licensed manufacturers and 5 dispensaries in the state. Those dispensaries are in Windsor Heights, Sioux City, Council Bluffs, Waterloo, and Iowa City. In 2020, one of the state's cannabidiol manufacturers shut down permanently, leaving just one manufacturer, Bud and Mary's, to distribute products for the state program. Iowa also has awarded a license to Iowa Cannabis Company, which currently operates 3 of the state's dispensaries to serve as a cannabidiol manufacturer. The production facility is scheduled to come online later in 2024. Participation in the program is limited to Iowans with certain qualifying medical conditions, which include cancer if the treatment or the disease has side effects that include severe or chronic pain, nausea, or severe vomiting, or severe wasting, seizures, Crohn's disease, chronic pain, multiple sclerosis with severe and persistent muscle spasms, AIDS or HIV, ALS, Parkinson's disease, post-traumatic stress disorder, any terminal illness with a probable life expectancy of less than 1 year, ulcerative colitis, severe intractable autism with self-injurious or aggressive behaviors in both children and adults, and corticobasal degeneration. The program reported a total of 18,000 active patient cardholders and 3,700 active caregiver cardholders as of November 2023, the latest state data available. That compares with December of 2022, when the state data reported about 14,500 active patients and about 3,100 active caregivers in the program. The state program saw $13.6 million in cumulative sales last year, a 24% increase from the 10 sales surpassed $1 million every month in 2023. The Iowa legislature regularly considers changes to the state's medical cannabidiol program. That includes a bill that passed the Iowa Senate on April the 2nd, Senate File 2335, that would increase the number of licensed medical dispensaries in the state from 5 to 10, but the Iowa House didn't pass the bill before the 2024 legislative session ended early Saturday morning. The next opportunity for changes would be the 2025 session starting in January. Because of state policymakers' reluctance to make major adjustments to the program's existing framework, some advocates say they are not hopeful Iowa will soon have a more inclusive medical marijuana program. I think that the political realities within the state are going to make positive cannabis policy reform fairly difficult for the foreseeable future, Fox said. Even as medical cannabis use is strictly regulated and recreational use remains illegal in the state, many have pointed out Iowans can still access these products through other means. In recent years, Iowans have flocked to nearby states that have legalized recreational marijuana, such as Illinois. And within the state, businesses selling consumable hemp products have become extremely popular. These products are legal under the 2018 Farm Bill and contain formulations of CBD and THC that some say can benefit individuals with certain health problems. State officials that oversee Iowa's medical cannabidiol program have said the strict nature of the program has likely driven some Iowans to seek relief from hemp products. In general, especially in states like Iowa, where cannabis forms are limited, these products are more popular. There is more demand considering they are legal, Owen Parker, Bureau Chief of Iowa's Bureau of Cannabis Regulation, previously said. Both state officials say the lack of regulation over these products poses a risk to users' safety, particularly those who may be relying on consumable hemp to treat their symptoms. In addition, Fox said obtaining marijuana from a legal state and traveling back to Iowa, where recreational use is illegal, could open the door for Iowans to face criminal charges. Twyla?
Thanks, Scott. And that concludes the stories from the front page section, the front page of the Des Moines Register. We'll move now to the Metro and Iowa section. The first story, rent prices across the Midwest are climbing. This is a story from the Iowa City Press Citizen. Since March 2023, national rent prices have been increasing, especially in the Midwest. So how do Iowa's rent prices compare? National median rent prices have continued to rise since the beginning of the year, according to data from Rent.com. During the high season demand heading into the spring and summer months, rent is anticipated to continue to increase on a month-to-month basis. The national median rent price is $1,987, which increased 0.8% from March 2023 to 2024, or a $15 increase. Since the start of the pandemic in March of 2020, rent prices nationally have risen 21.8% and peaked in August of 2022 when the median rental cost was about $2,053. The rental increases have been sharper in the Midwest. Rent in the Midwest rose by 5.3%, with the current median price of an apartment costing on average $1,456 per month, or up about $73 compared to last year, according to Rent.com. However, the Midwest remains the most affordable region in the U.S., being about $531 cheaper than the national median. Analysis from real estate website Redfin pointed to a lack of new construction in the Midwest as a driver behind rent increases. Like the Midwest, rent prices have been rising in the Northeast. The region has the highest rent in the U.S. and experienced a 3.8% increase since last year, with the median rent cost now $2,504 a month. Iowa is on the top 10 list for rent price increases in 2024. The median rent across the state is $1,175, which marks a 6.8% increase from last year and a 1.1% increase since March of this year, according to Rent.com. Minnesota tops the list for the biggest increases, with rent prices jumping 13.3% in the last year, with the median rent coming in at $1,679. While rent is rising in the Midwest, states like Florida are seeing decreases. The median rent in Florida dropped 8.8%, but median rent of $2,117 in Florida is still $130 more than the median cost nationwide. Iowa has the fourth largest median rent prices in the U.S., according to Rent.com data, with a median monthly cost of $1,175. Oklahoma has the lowest median rent at $1,028, which is $147 cheaper than Iowa. In 2024, the average rent for apartments in Des Moines ranged from $949 to $1,123. Studios averaged $949, while one bedrooms averaged $1,103, and two bedrooms cost $1,077, according to Rent.com. Currently, Massachusetts has the highest median rent price at $3,243, followed by California, where the median rent is $3,007.
Thanks, Twyla. Next, expansion underway at the Surf Ballroom. New structure to include ticket office, studios. This is written by Allison Lathers of the Des Moines Register. Iowa's most venerated rock music landmark will soon have an expanded visitor center dedicated to preserving its story and fame. Clear Lake on Wednesday held a groundbreaking for the new Music Enrichment and Immersive Center to be built just to the west of the Surf Ballroom as part of a gateway to what the city calls the Surf District. In addition to a visitor center, the new two-story structure will house a ticket office, gift shop, studios for music lessons, conference space, a catering kitchen, and an 1,800 square foot immersive exploratory space to showcase the history behind the North Iowa resort town's claim to fame. Future Rock and Roll Hall of Famers Buddy Holly and Richie Valens, along with the big bopper J.P. Richardson, performed their winter dance party tour at the Surf Ballroom on February the 2nd, 1959. Early the following morning, they were killed when a plane taking off to carry them to their next gig crashed in a snow-covered cornfield on the edge of town. The 91-year-old venue holds an annual party of the same name to honor the rock legends. The loss of Holly is remembered as the day the music died, so dubbed by singer Don McLean in his 1971 hit American Pie. The ballroom was officially designated as a national landmark in 2021. The Iowa Economic Development Authority awarded the planned center a $4.3 million Destination Iowa grant, and it also will receive a $400,000 Community Attraction and Tourism grant. Other public and private investment in the project amounts to $35.2 million and will include a gateway market for the Surf District over Buddy Holly Place and a link from the ballroom to the lakeshore. Valens' sister Connie spoke at the ceremony. "Walking through the doors of the Surf is new every time for me. It's a home away from home," she said. "When I heard about the Enrichment Center, I thought yet another portion of the Surf is reaching out to touch different people in the community. To come in and learn what the Surf is all about, that's the music that was played here, is played here, and will continue to be played here." Built in 1933 on the north shore of Clear Lake by entrepreneur Carl J. Fox, the original Surf Ballroom was designed by Hanson and Wagner, a Mason City architecture firm now operating in Clear Lake and Ankeny as Atura Architecture. The Surf burned down in April 20th, 1947, to Prom Inc. of Chicago, the original developer, and turned to Hanson and Wagner for design and construction of a new ballroom. Although it retained its original beach club style, the new Surf had more seating, a larger dance floor. Today, it's noted as a well-preserved example of the modern style of architecture. Elements of the original Surf will be incorporated into the new center, according to the city. The center will serve as a starting point for tours of both the ballroom and the Fox's preserved home across North Shore Drive. Under terms of the state grant, The work on the new structure must be completed by mid-2026.
Another mini golf is coming to the Metro. Golf, or the indoor semblance of it, is having a moment in the Des Moines Metro. Top Golf in West Des Moines is ahead of schedule and could open its all-weather hitting bays by late summer. Fat Putter, a popular miniature golf lounge in Omaha, Nebraska, announced a new location in downtown Des Moines earlier this month. They will join Putts and Pins in West Des Moines. And now a second mini golf venue is readying for a downtown Des Moines debut. Aaron Coy plans to open Crazy Golf in a 22,000-square-foot warehouse at 338 Southwest 6th Street, south of West Martin Luther King Parkway, that already houses two of his other participatory recreation ventures, Axe Throwing Venue, Lumber Axe, and Escape Chambers. Coy launched his first Crazy Golf location 2 months ago in Waukesha, Wisconsin, and says he has four more in the works. Des Moines is his next stop. We started as laser tag in Des Moines in 2013, he said. We've expanded as we went. Now we have a little bit of everything, he added. Coy calls his new concept an infusion of golf and excitement. The Des Moines location will open with four courses totaling 36 holes and a bar with signature cocktails. Some holes will feature mini games like foosball, while others will offer photo opportunities like a Harley-Davidson motorcycle obstacle. At 9 p.m. on days it's open, Crazy Golf will become an adults-only playground with prompts for a never-have-I-ever game at each hole. It's different. It's not your typical mini-golf, Coy said. He knows he will be five short blocks from Fat Putter in the Wilkins Building at 713 Walnut Street, another indoor high-concept mini-golf lounge aiming for a fall completion date. If he knew then what he does now, he said, he would have brought Crazy Golf to Des Moines sooner. We should have worked on ours first, he said. We'll be pretty close. It'll be interesting. Crazy Golf could open in October. Putts and Pins opened in November near Jordan Creek Town Center with what it describes as high-tech gamified mini-golf. And Bombers Golf, under construction in Johnston, will offer an indoor mini-golf course snaking through an arcade as well as an outdoor course. But Putts and Pins planted its flag, mini golf in the Des Moines metro area. Before Putts and Pins planted its flag, mini golf in the Des Moines metro area was largely dominated by seasonal outdoor putt-putt courses like West Grand Golf and Jester's Park Golf's miniature courses. Glow Golf, a Wichita-based chain of indoor mini golf courses, closed its Jordan Creek Town Center location in 2019 before briefly reopening and then closing again in 2021. Putts and Pins owner Mitchell Kahn told the Register that he sees Putts and Pins being first of a chain he and his brother will build in mid-sized cities.
20-foot-tall pavilion to be built at Waterworks Park. This is written by Byong M. Byong of the Des Moines Register. Water Curia, 20-foot-tall circular pavilion coming to the Des Moines Waterworks Park, also will serve as a public classroom to honor the late Bill Stowe, the longtime water utility CEO and general manager who died in 2019. Stowe, remembered as a public servant pushing to protect Iowa's waterways, died at 60 years old from pancreatic cancer, a shock to Iowans and those who knew him personally. The William G. Stowe Foundation, a foundation formed in Stowe's honor, is bringing the permanent installation to the 1,500-acre urban park in downtown Des Moines. Bill and I spent a lot of time together, became great friends, fought a water legal battle in the state with drainage districts, said Graham Gillette, board member for the foundation and Des Moines Waterworks, referring to the utility's lawsuit against drainage districts and their role in Iowa's water quality. A federal judge ultimately dismissed the suit, saying water quality problems are up to the state legislature to resolve. Water Curia was designed by Des Moines native Jordan Weber, recipient of the 2023 Guggenheim Award and the 2022 United States Artist Award. The pavilion will sit along Fleur Drive between Gray's Lake and the Lordson Amphitheater in a nestle of trees, with installations set to begin in the fall. It's being paid for with donations from individuals and various organizations throughout central Iowa, according to Gillette. The purpose is to further interest in discussion and advocacy, if you will, on water and environmental issues, Gillette said. That is something Bill would be very proud of, and I'm sure he's cheering us on from above. The pavilion will feature large natural stones at its base that lead to smaller stones, reflecting how groundwater is purified beneath the park through a series of underground pipes located throughout Waterworks Park. The first 2 million gallons of water used by Central Iowans every day come from this natural gallery system, Gillette said. The natural filtration system was Weber's inspiration for water curia. To additionally supplement the educational aspect of the pavilion, the School of Education at Drake University will develop signs, interactive displays, and activities for park visitors to peruse, according to the Greater Des Moines Partnership. Gillette said the school currently is testing a hands-on water purification activity with local fifth graders. Bill had a strong influence on people and was a person who brought people together, and so it makes perfect sense to build something in Des Moines Waterworks Park, partly to remember Bill, which would bother him, he said. He never would want his name on something necessarily, but to further his legacy of these issues, that's something that would please him.
And we'll wrap up the Metro and Iowa section with this short story. Des Moines Public Schools settles Hoover High's stabbing suit for $5,000. Des Moines Public Schools will pay $5,000 to settle claims by a student who was stabbed during a fight outside Hoover High School. The March 2022 attack left the student with several abdominal lacerations requiring medical treatment, according to court filings. In his complaint, he alleged teachers saw other students threatening and trying to fight him inside the school, but took no action to separate them or prevent the subsequent encounter. He was wounded in a parking lot outside. The suit was filed in September of 2023, and on April 15, the student filed to permanently dismiss the case. A spokesperson for the district confirmed it had agreed to settle the case for $5,000 paid by its insurer. The student's attorney declined to comment. The district in November settled for $30,000, a similar lawsuit, by the parents of an elementary school student who suffered severe injuries from being shoved into playground equipment by an alleged bully.
Back in the front section of the Des Moines Register on page 3A, we have an article entitled, Jury Says Ex-Officer's Resignation is Final. Lawsuit claimed notice was coerced. It's written by Ryan Hansen of the Iowa City Press Citizen. A former Iowa City police officer's claim that his resignation was withdrawn before being accepted by the city has been ruled invalid by a jury. Emilio Puente, age 26, began working for the Iowa City Police Department in April of 2019, transferring from the Johnson County Ambulance Service. City officials opened an inquiry into Puente in late 2021 after he made an arrest in downtown Iowa City. The investigation revealed that Puente and the suspect engaged in a brief altercation when the suspect resisted. Puente submitted his resignation in February of 2022, writing, "I am aware of the position I put you in that led to this moment. I believe it is in my best interest and the best interest of the Iowa City Police Department to tender my resignation at this time," according to court documents. It was never publicly revealed why Puente left the department, but he claims he submitted the resignation under duress. In January 2022, City of Iowa City pre-disciplinary hearing report delivered to Puente revealed a handful of incidents in the fall of 2021. Puente initiated contact with a female along Clinton Street on Halloween night, October the 31st, in which he allegedly unreasonably and unnecessarily slapped a beverage can out of her hand. The report said the situation escalated. The female then allegedly struck out toward Puente, and he allegedly applied force, which Puente did not document as required per department policy. Less than 2 weeks later, in November of 2021, Puente was assisting in the arrest of another individual near Clinton Street. As two officers restrained the individual on the ground, Puente allegedly struck the individual in the head with a closed fist. The city investigators said the alleged action was not reasonable or necessary. A pre-disciplinary hearing was set for February the 3rd, 2022, 3 days after the report was filed. Puente argued that in the days leading up to his resignation, senior co-workers told him that if he did not resign, he would likely never be allowed to work in law enforcement again, according to Puente's petition. Puente's lawsuit claimed Police Chief Dustin Liston summoned Puente to a meeting on February the 3rd and informed him that he had 2 hours to submit his resignation or his employment would be terminated. According to court documents, Puente texted two different individuals within the Iowa City Police Department in separate conversations the next day on February the 4th, 2022, asking if he could rescind his resignation. When asked what changed by one of the individuals, Puente replied with, "When I was thinking of the positives and negatives between resigning or getting fired, I was too emotional to think through both options and make a clear decision. After talking with several people, I think resigning might have been the wrong choice." Puente claims that in an ensuing phone call with the individual, "Liston will not rescind my resignation." Puente subsequently approached the city of Iowa City on April 15, 2022, and asked to withdraw his resignation. The request was denied. Puente asked the court to reverse Iowa City's decision not to rescind his resignation letter, which would have reinstated him as a city employee. He claimed his resignation was the product of duress and therefore null and void.
And moving now to some international news that's also in the front page section of the Register. Reports say U.S. to sanction Israeli battalion. This is from USA Today. Some Israeli leaders are lashing out at reported plans by the Biden administration to sanction an ultra-Orthodox Israeli combat unit that for years has faced claims of abuse against Palestinians. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu described the intention to impose sanctions on the Netzach Yehuda Battalion as the height of absurdity and moral nadir. That's using Mr. Netanyahu's words. "If anyone thinks they can impose sanctions on a military unit, I will fight it with all my strength," Netanyahu said in a statement. Axios and the Israeli media outlet Haaretz reported the battalion could be banned from receiving U.S. military assistance or training. The battalion, among other issues, was linked in the death of an 80-year-old Palestinian American in 2022. Haaretz said the Biden administration is considering sanctions against other military and police units in Israel. The U.S. State Department did not immediately respond to a request for comment from USA Today. Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich said sanctions, while Israel is fighting for its existence, would be, in his words, absolute madness. But Israeli Labor Party leader Merav Mikhali dismissed the government's outrage as yet another dose of denial and smearing, lies and covering up the bitter reality. Mikhali described the battalion as a regiment of hill boys and just those who see religion as an excuse to attack Arabs. That's the end of the quote from Mr. Mikhali. A baby girl was delivered from the womb of a Palestinian killed in Rafah as Israel bombing intensified in the southern Gaza city, Palestinian health officials said. The baby was delivered by emergency C-section, was stable, and was improving, according to Dr. Mohammed Salama. At least 19 people, including 13 children, died when two houses were struck overnight into Sunday, authorities said. Gaza is home to more than 1 million people, including hundreds of thousands who fled fighting elsewhere in the enclave. "Here is the biggest tragedy. Even if this child survives, she was born an orphan," Salama said. Netanyahu has pledged to continue the Israeli campaign in Gaza, which authorities say has killed more than 34,000 Palestinians, until all the hostages are brought home and Hamas has been destroyed. Hamas-led gunmen seized 253 people during the October 7 attack that killed 1,200, according to Israeli tallies. Some hostages were freed in a November truce, but efforts to secure another deal appear to have stalled. In the West Bank, 14 militants were killed, 15 were arrested, a large amount of ammunition and explosives were confiscated, and two explosive laboratories were destroyed Sunday in an operation at the Nur Shams refugee camp, the Israeli military said in a statement. 9 soldiers were wounded, the statement said. Meanwhile, a Palestinian woman who attempted to stab soldiers at a checkpoint in the West Bank's Jordan Valley was, quote, neutralized, end quote, the Israeli military said. No troops were wounded at the Bekaat checkpoint. Violence in the West Bank, already on the rise before the Israel-Hamas war in Gaza, has escalated since with frequent army raids on militant groups, rampages by Jewish settlers in Palestinian villages, and Palestinian street attacks. The Israeli army said that its soldiers shot 2 Palestinians who tried to shoot and stab them on Sunday in the West Bank, and the Palestinian Health Ministry said both men had died. One of the terrorists attempted to stab IDF soldiers that were in the area, who responded with live fire and neutralized him, the Israel military said. At the same time, the other terrorist opened fire on the soldiers, who responded with live fire and neutralized him, too, end of the quote. An Israeli prosecutor has indicted an outspoken sister of Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh on charges of aiding a terrorist organization and incitement to terrorism, the Times of Israel reported. The indictment against Sabah al-Salam Haniyeh, 57, accuses her of sending 2 WhatsApp messages to dozens of her contacts, including her brother, quote, praising, encouraging, and supporting Hamas for its role in the October 7 attack on Israel. The state attorney asked a court to hold her until legal proceedings have concluded. She faces a total of more than 20 years in prison if convicted on all charges. And finally, from Iran, Khomeini says Iran demonstrated its power against Israel. Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khomeini, said the country's armed forces for their attack. Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khomeini, thanked the country's armed forces for their attack this month on Israel, saying the country had demonstrated its power, Iran's official news agency reported on Sunday. How many missiles were launched and how many of them hit their target is not the primary question. What really matters is that Iran demonstrated its power during that operation, Khomeini said on Sunday. In its first ever direct attack on Israel, Iran sent a barrage of more than 300 missiles and drones on April 13 in what is said was retaliation for Israel's suspected deadly strike on its embassy compound in Damascus on April 1. Most of the missiles and drones were shot down by Israel and its allies, including the United States, and the attack caused modest damage in Israel. Early on Friday, explosions echoed over the Iranian city of Isfahan in what sources said was an Israeli attack. Tehran played down the incident and said it had no plans for retaliation.
In the Nation and World Extra section on page 7N, I'll read some brief articles before we hit the top of the hour. First, Papua New Guinea says nation undeserving of cannibalism label. Dateline is Sydney. Papua New Guinea Prime Minister James Marape says his nation does not deserve to be labeled cannibals and urged the U.S. to clear up the remnants of World War II littered across the Pacific after comments by President Joe Biden about his missing serviceman uncle. Biden had appeared to imply his uncle was eaten by cannibals after his plane was shot down over PNG during World War II, Marape's office said in a statement late on Sunday. President Biden's remarks may have been a slip of the tongue, However, my country does not deserve to be labeled as such, Marape said in the statement. I urge President Biden to get the White House to look into cleaning up these remains of World War II so the truth about missing servicemen like Ambrose Finnegan can be put to rest. The U.S. signed a defense cooperation agreement with Papua New Guinea last year amid competition for influence in the region with China, which has a security pact with neighboring Solomon Islands. China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi met with Marape in the capital Port Moresby on Sunday to build closer economic ties, while Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese arrives this week to commemorate World War II history. Next, Haiti's capital under gang attacks ahead of government transition. The dateline is Port-au-Prince. Armed gangs launched fresh attacks on parts of Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, ahead of the installation of a transitional council set to usher in a new government, local media said on Sunday, reporting arson and heavy gunfire in the city's center. The lower Delmas area is turning into a battlefield between police and armed gangs, Radio Telegalaxy said on X, saying loud blasts were heard as far as the neighborhood's city hall, as well as automatic gunfire near the National Palace. Two voice recordings circulated on social media, which users attributed to gang leader Jimmy Barbecue Cherizier, apparently ordering his soldiers to burn houses down in Lower Delmas, an impoverished part of the capital where he grew up. Continue burning the houses. Make everyone leave, a man says in the first audio recording. In another, he says he has sent jugs of gasoline. No need to know which house. Burn every house you find. Set the fire, he says. Reuters was unable to verify the recording, but a resident from the area told Reuters she had seen houses on fire. The State University of Haiti's medical facility was also looted by gangs overnight. Radio RFM reported, while attacks were also reported in the Hillside Petition Villa suburb. This comes as the country prepares for the installation of a 9-member council to take over from Prime Minister Ariel Henry, who pledged to step down on March the 11th while stranded outside the country and under pressure from the United States. And finally, asking prices for UK homes close to record high, Rightmove says, and the dateline is London. Prices of homes being sold in Britain are close to their record highs after the biggest annual increase in a year, according to an industry survey that suggested the momentum in housing market of early 2024 extended into April. Property website Rightmove said on Monday its asking prices for residential properties rose by 1.7% in the 4 weeks to April 13th when compared by the same period last year. Prices sought by sellers rose 1.1% in a month-to-month terms, slowing from a 1.5% increase in the previous 4 weeks. The average new seller asking price of £372,324 was only £570 off of a record hit in May of 2023, Rightmove said. Other measures of Britain's housing market have also shown a recovery in demand and prices, helped by a fall in borrowing costs, which surged in 2022 when former Prime Minister Liz Truss's plan for sweeping tax cuts upset financial markets. Rightmove said the number of new sellers was 12% higher than a year earlier, and the number of sales was up by 13%. Demand was strongest in the high-end segment, where prices in 2024 so far are up by the most since 2014. Demand for properties typically sought by first and second-time buyers rose by less, the survey showed.